Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So let's just jump right into it. I want to start by reevaluating a fundamental assumption we have in cell biology.
Okay, I like where this is going.
Right, so if you study cellular communication, you are intimately familiar with extracellular vesicles, specifically, you know, exosomes. Right. And we've operated for decades on this premise that these tiny lipid bilayers are essentially just protective armor.
Right, like a microscopic shipping container.
Exactly. The assumption has always been that the functional cargo, so, you know, the RNA transcripts, the genomic DNA fragments, all those actionable biological instructions, that they're safely sequestered inside the exosome lumen, guarded from the nucleuses that are just patrolling the extracellular space.
Which, I mean, logically makes sense. You want to protect the payload.
Yeah.
You do. But consider the topological implications if we actually had that backward. What if the most critical signaling mechanism wasn't the nucleic acid buried inside the vesicle, but a complex array of DNA actively plastered on the outside of the glass, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a massive distinction. I mean, the spatial organization of a molecule completely dictates its potential interactome.
Right.
The DNA is internalized, it's just a payload waiting for delivery.
Hmm.
But if it's externalized, it is an active, immediate ligand that's touching everything it bumps into.
And that's exactly the mystery we are tackling in today's deep dive. How does that change our understanding of tumor microenvironments, innate immune sensing, and just the mechanics of how stress cells broadcast their state? But before we get into the mechanics of how this was proven, we really need to celebrate the work of the research team at the University of Chicago.
Oh, absolutely.
This includes Bushovich, Gupta, Zhang, Krishnan, and Sostak. Their 2026 publication in PNAS has just massively advanced our understanding of both extracellular vesicles and, honestly, nucleic acid chemistry in general.
Yeah, they tackled a problem that has bottlenecked spatial transcriptomics for years, which is, you know, how do you map the precise location of nucleic acids without just completely destroying the native molecule in the process?
Right, because historically we've been trapped between two pretty flawed methodologies, haven't we?
We really have. I mean, if you try to use enzymatic labeling, where you rely on polymerases or ligases to attach a fluorophore, you are completely constrained by sequence specificity.
Because the enzymes need specific codes to bind.
Exactly. They require specific motifs or secondary structures, so you're only ever labeling a biased fraction of the total nucleic acid pool. Plus, enzymes are massive proteins. They face severe steric hindrance when they try to access tightly packed molecular environments like an exosome.
So they just physically can't fit into the spaces we need them to.
Right. And so the alternative to that has always been sequence-independent chemical labeling. But that comes with its own severe drawbacks.
Yeah, the brute force approach.
Totally. Methods using carbidamide condensation, like EDC or CMC reagents, they essentially force a reaction with the Watson-Crick pairing faces of the nucleobases. And sure, you successfully attach your label, but in doing so, you form these irreversible covalent adducts. You permanently alter the chemical structure of the nucleic acid.
Which kind of defeats the purpose, right? It's like you found the letter, but you spilled ink all over it, so you can't read it anymore.
That's a perfect analogy. The sample is useless for downstream applications. You can't sequence a heavily modified cross-linked DNA strand. You can't study its natural function. The native conformation is just gone.
And the exosome itself gets wrecked too, right?
Oh, yeah. The structural integrity of the exosome is often compromised by those harsh reaction conditions. This whole mess is what the field termed the exosome conundrum.
The exosome conundrum. I love that term.
It's catchy. But basically, we could detect DNA associated with exosome pellets via sequencing. But we lacked a chemically gentle, reversible probe to determine whether that DNA was actually luminal, meaning inside, or surface adhered.
So we knew the ink was there, to go back to the envelope analogy, but we couldn't tell if the writing was on the letter inside or scrawled across the front of the envelope.
Exactly. And that's where the University of Chicago team comes in. They engineered this remarkably elegant chemical solution, which they named RUNA.
RUNA, reversible uridine natrillium mediated addition.
It's a mouthful, but the chemistry is beautiful. I want to unpack this a bit because it operates on this brilliant exploitation of basic peak and I values.
Walk us through it. What are the ingredients here?
So the reaction relies on just two commercially available precursors, an aldehyde and an isonitrile.
Wait, just those two?
Just those two. When you combine them under the right conditions, they condense to form this highly reactive intermediate known as a nitrillium ion. And the specificity of where this ion binds is entirely dictated by the pH of the biological environment.
Okay, so the researchers ran this at a slightly basic pH, right? Like around 8.0 to 10.
Yep. And at that specific pH, the N3-amide position on uridine bases in RNA and thymidine bases in DNA undergoes deprotonation.
Because the pK of that specific nitrogen is around 9.2, right?
Exactly. So it loses a proton, becomes a highly reactive nucleophile, and is just primed to attack that nitrolium ion we just made.
Okay, so it attacks it, forms a covalent bond, and boom, you've tagged the UNT bases.
Right. But here's the real paradigm shift for spatial biology. That bond is thermally labile.
Meaning you can break it with heat?
Yes. If you expose the labeled sample to 95 degrees Celsius for just 15 minutes, the bond hydrolyzes. The label detaches entirely.
Wow, so it just pops right off.
It just pops off, leaving the native unmodified nucleic acid perfectly pristine for sequencing or functional assays later on.
So instead of spray painting the DNA permanently, RUNA acts like a chemical post-it note that you can just easily peel off with a little bit of heat.
That is exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And for anyone doing spatial transcriptomics, the ability to visualize a transcript and then cleanly erase the label without degrading the molecule is a massive, massive technical leap.
But they didn't just stop there. To solve the exosome conundrum, they had to utilize the modular nature of RUNA, right?
Right. Because the nitrilium ion is made by combining an isonitrile and an aldehyde. You can finely tune the chemical properties of the final tag simply by swapping out the aldehyde precursor.
Okay, so how did they use that to figure out the inside versus outside problem?
Well, they exploited that modularity to manipulate membrane permeability. If they synthesize RUNA using a hydrophobic aldehyde-like Norborne aldehyde, the reagent readily partitions into the lipid bilayer. It just crosses right through the membrane and indiscriminately labels all the nucleic acids.
So that gets everything. Inside the exosome, outside the exosome, all of it.
Yep. But conversely, if you swap that hydrophobic precursor for a highly charged molecule, like betaine aldehyde, which has a quaternary ammonium cation on it, the resulting reagent is physically and electrostatically excluded from crossing the hydrophobic core of the lipid bilayer.
Oh, that's clever.
It acts as an impermeable chemical fence. It exclusively labels the nucleic acids exposed to the extracellular environment.
But wait, I have to ask a critical question here. How do we know this chemistry isn't just accidentally labeling everything else? I mean, a biological sample is a complex soup. You've got adenines, cytosines, proteins with primary amines. If you drop a highly reactive intermediate into that, thermodynamics usually dictates you'll see some off-target binding.
And the researchers absolutely anticipated that skepticism. They had to rigorously validate the selectivity.
So how did they prove it heavily prefers the UNT bases?
They used one-dimensional proton nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy NMR on synthetic tinamar oligonucleotides.
Okay.
By comparing pure adenine, cytosine, and guanine strands against pure uridine strands under the RUNA reaction conditions, the NMR spectra gave them unequivocal structural proof. The kinetics overwhelmingly favor that deprotonated N3 position of uridine and thymidine. Any trace off-target labeling was statistically negligible.
Okay, so the tool is validated, it's precise, it's reversible, it can be made membrane impermeable, so they finally pointed it at the exosomes.
Yes. They applied the membrane impermeable betaine aldehyde construct to exosomes derived from my CCAP, which is a well-characterized murine prostate cancer cell line. And they linked the RUNA chemistry to a fluorophore, specifically sulfo-C3 tetrazine, so they could actually see it.
And what did they see?
The imaging data revealed a profound fluorescent signal localized directly to the exosome surface. Because the region couldn't penetrate the bilayer, this definitively confirmed that the DNA was topologically on the exterior.
But just to play devil's advocate, how do we know it wasn't just like dye aggregation on the lipid membrane itself?
Great point. To prove that, they took those labeled exosomes and treated them with DNase-IO.
And DNase-I is an enzyme that literally chews up exposed DNA.
Exactly. It cleaves phosphodiester bonds. Mm. And importantly, it's a huge protein, roughly 30 kilodaltons. So it is way too massive to passively diffuse into an intact vesicle.
So it can only eat what's on the outside.
Right. And upon adding the DNase-I, the fluorescence signal completely plummeted. It just vanished. The enzyme cleaved the exposed DNA, release the fluorophore into the supernatant, and that orthogonal validation proved the signal was undeniably tethered to to surface-exposed nucleic acids.
Exosomes absolutely have DNA on their outer surface. That is incredible. But the story gets crazier because then they introduced a cancer drug into the mix.
Yeah, this is where the biological implications get really fascinating. They introduced rucaparib.
Which is a PRP inhibitor, right? A pretty common anti-cancer drug.
Yes. By inhibiting PRP, the drug prevents the repair of single-strand DNA breaks. Those eventually degenerate into double-strand breaks during replication, which induces severe genotoxic stress in the cell.
Okay, so the cancer cells are stressed out, their DNA is breaking apart. What happens to the exosomes they secrete?
The quantitative data shifted dramatically. When the cells were cultured with rucaparib, the exosomes they secreted exhibited nearly double the amount of surface-adhered DNA compared to the untreated controls.
Double.
But wait, we have to evaluate the physical integrity of the cells here. If you expose a cancer cell line to a potent chemotherapeutic agent, you are initiating apoptosis. The cells are dying. They're breaking apart. Hmm. Could the rucaparib just be destroying the cells, and the supposed surface DNA is really just sticky genomic debris from ruptured cells clinging to random vesicle fragments?
It's a totally necessary skepticism.
Right.
But they checked for exactly that. To confirm the vesicles were intact, they used nanoparticle tracking analysis, or NTA.
Right, which tracks the Brownian motion of particles to calculate their size.
Yes. And they used dynamic light scattering, DLS, alongside it. Both of these biophysical assays confirmed that the exosomes from the drug-treated cells were morphologically indistinguishable from the controls.
No way.
Yeah. They maintained a uniform, intact spherical structure, consistent diameter of roughly 100 to 150 nanometers. The vesicle abundance remained stable. There was absolutely no evidence of membrane rupture or fragmentation.
So the vesicles were fully intact. They just had way more DNA strapped to the outside.
Exactly. The cells were actively and purposefully loading twice as much DNA onto the exterior of these intact exosomes.
Which requires us to ask the big question, why? What is the evolutionary logic there? Why would a cell actively load DNA onto the outer leaflet of a lipid vesicle, especially during severe genotoxic stress?
The data points toward two interconnected mechanisms, and it starts with basic cellular self-preservation. When DNA damage occurs, fragments accumulate in the cytosol. And that is a lethal threat to the cell because cytosolic DNA is the primary trigger for the CGS sting pathway.
Oh, right. The innate immune sensing mechanism. If a cell detects DNA floating around where it shouldn't be, it hits the self-destruct button.
Exactly. It initiates a signaling cascade that ends in apoptosis. So the cancer cell, desperately trying to survive the drug, has to rapidly clear these genotoxic fragments from its cytosol to prevent CGS sting from auto-activating.
So exporting the DNA on the outside of an exosome is basically a highly efficient waste disposal mechanism.
That's the first part. But the biological consequence extends way beyond just taking out the trash. Because once that surface DNA enters the extracellular space, it transforms from waste into a potent paracrine signal.
It changes the tumor microenvironment.
Radically. And this brings us to the role of tumor-associated macrophages, or TAMs.
Okay, so typically in a tumor environment, macrophages are kind of the bad guys, right? They adopt this M2-like state, which is anti-inflammatory, and actually helps the tumor grow.
Right. They secrete factors for tissue repair, they stimulate new blood vessels for the tumor, and they suppress the immune system. The tumor basically recruits them to act as a localized support system.
So what happens when these M2 macrophages encounter these exosomes covered in surface DNA?
It's essentially a feeding frenzy. The researchers observed that when the M2 macrophages were incubated with the high surface DNA exosomes, the ones from the stress cells, the macrophages actively internalized the vesicles at a significantly accelerated rate compared to normal exosomes.
Why do they eat them so much faster?
It happens via scavenger receptors on the macrophage membrane. These receptors evolve specifically to identify and bind polyanionic ligands. And because DNA has that repeating sugar phosphate backbone, it is essentially a massive, highly negatively charged polymer.
So the surface DNA acts like a giant molecular eat-me sign.
Precisely. The dense accumulation of negative charge aggressively cross-links with the scavenger receptors and forces endocytosis. The macrophage just gulls it up.
Okay, they eat the exosome, but does it actually change the macrophage's behavior?
It causes a massive phenotypic shift. The internalization of these highly charged vesicles initiates a profound reprogramming. The macrophages rapidly shifted away from that immunosuppressive M2 state.
Yet they flip?
They flip entirely. They started producing high levels of type interferon, IL-12, and TNF-alpha.
Wow. Let's look at what that cytokine milieu actually does, because that's huge. IL-12 is a primary driver of Th1 cellular immunity, right? It promotes naive T cells to become active, tumor-targeting effector cells.
Yes, and it heavily stimulates natural killer cells. And simultaneously, the TNF-alpha induces direct cytotoxicity in malignant cells and drives localized inflammation.
So they shifted from being tumor helpers to acting like M1 macrophages, the pro-inflammatory tumor-fighting kind.
Exactly. They were recruited by the tumor to heal it, but the surface DNA on those exosomes reprogrammed them to attack it.
And how do we know for sure it was the surface DNA causing this and not something inside the exosome?
Because of the ultimate control experiment. When they pre-treated those same exosomes with DNAs, completely stripping the DNA from the surface before giving them to the macrophages, the entire repolarization effect failed. The macrophages just stayed in their M2 state.
That is the smoking gun. That proves definitively that the topological display of the DNA is the biological trigger, not the luminal cargo.
It completely forces a reevaluation of how exosomes mediate innate immune sensing. It provides a direct mechanistic bridge between a cell experiencing catastrophic DNA damage and the subsequent systemic immune response.
I mean, that is just elegant science. But as we look at the boundaries of this specific study, we should note the limitations, right? They utilized a highly controlled in vitro system with a specific murine cancer line.
Right. Moving forward, the field will definitely need to validate this surface display phenomenon in primary tissue-derived exosomes.
And we still don't know the exact sequences of the surface-bound DNA, do we?
No, we don't. Are these just random, sheared genomic fragments? Or are these specific, purposefully exported motifs, like unmethylated CpG islands, which we know are highly immunogenic?
Right. And I guess we also don't know exactly how the cell physically tethers a highly charged nucleic acid polymer to a hydrophobic lipid membrane in the first place.
That structural mechanism is a huge next step. Are there intermediate transmembrane binding proteins involved? Or are there direct lipid-nucleic acid interactions happening during vesicle biogenesis? We just don't know yet.
But the introduction of the RUNA methodology by the UChicago team finally gives us the chemical tool we need to actually answer those questions.
Exactly. They engineered a reversible, location-specific tool that resolved a major structural debate.
And they proved that exosomal DNA isn't just passive cargo trapped inside a bubble. It is actively displayed on the surface, where it acts as a dynamic signal that can fundamentally rewire immune cells.
It's a completely new way of looking at cell-to-cell communication.
It really is, and it leaves us with such a profound question for the future of cancer treatment. Because if the spatial presentation of DNA is capable of reprogramming an immunosuppressive macrophage into an aggressive, tumor-fighting cell, could we one day artificially engineer exosomes, or synthetic lipid nanoparticles, heavily coated with specific surface DNA to act as targeted, programmable immune-boosting therapies for patients?
I mean, if the exterior display dictates the cellular response, the future of immunotherapy might really rely on engineering the outside of the vesicle rather than just the payload inside.
It's an incredible thought to end on. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
In the clean room glow, in a late night hush, tiny parcels drift where the signals rush. We thought the message stayed sealed inside, but something bright was riding the outside. A small switch flips with a careful heat, mark the letters where the membranes meet. Draw the line, what's in, what's out, turn the mystery into a map, no doubt. DNA under stress.
quiet cells change gears when they hear from easygoing to